Hello, everybody, and welcome back to the Rewatch Project with Hannah and Mike. I am Mike, and with me, as always, is Hannah. How are you this evening, Hannah?
I am not too bad. First day of the Easter break. I've had to work. The life of self-employed people the world over.
Always on the clock.
Always on the clock. Never a day off. Yeah, no, I'm good. I'm ready to get listening to some Twin Peaks.
Get listening to some Twin Peaks.
Get watching.
Even. I suppose you will be listening, just not exclusively.
I don't know what the fuck I'm doing, basically.
You've been working all day. We just put the kids to bed. You don't know who I am.
Yeah. What day is it?
We're going to enjoy some old-timey radio in the form of Twin Peaks.
Yeah. Basically, that's where my head's at, everybody.
And which episode of Twin Peaks are we covering? I'd say you're probably in the perfect frame of mind for an episode of Twin Peaks.
I'm ready to zone out and go into Twin Peaks world.
Yes.
The episode tonight is called Double Play.
Or Radio Play would probably be more accurate.
The IMDb synopsis.
IMDb.
I said IMDb.
You said IMDb.
I did not. I said IMDb.
I could stop and rewind it if you want to hear it.
Fucking stop and rewind it.
Okay, hang on. Okay. So have you got anything you'd like to say, Hannah?
No.
All right. So
it's like must be a blue moon.
Yeah. I think I'm so rarely that confident that I'm right.
I should have known as soon as you said, I'll play it back.
I should just record our entire lives. You're
okay. You go ahead and do that. See where it gets you.
Divorced would probably be the
correct answer. The synopsis for Double Play.
Synopsis from where?
From the internets. Has a spelling mistake in the first word.
Wow, what kind of idiot gets stuff like that wrong?
Well, I think this is where I may have gone wrong.
Oh, okay.
Because it's not a spelling mistake at all.
Is it not?
No.
Yeah, twice in one night.
No, his name is Windermill, but for some reason I thought it was Winsome.
Winsome, oh.
I'm really not having a good night.
Okay, now this has gone from being funny to actually feeling kind of bad for you.
I'm having a breakdown, everybody.
Yeah, she's got a wheat bag against her face at the moment. Yeah. All right, I'll stop being mean to you now. Let's go.
Right, here we go. Windermill has taken his first victim in the deadly chess game. Audrey tells Bobby they have to save Ben from his Civil War fantasy. Leo awakes and attacks Shelley, but Bobby is able to fend him off. It is directed by Yuli Edel.
Yep.
And written by Scott Frost.
Okay, brother of Mark Frost. I'm just looking up what Yuli Edel has done, because that's a first-time name on the show.
He was born in 1947 in Nuremberg.
Germany. Wow. Oh, I know some of his movies. He did a movie called Christian F in the early 80s. Wow. Oh, he directed Last Exit to Brooklyn. And he also directed Body of Evidence starring Madonna, the erotic thriller, you know, the knockoff of Basic Instinct. Do you remember that?
Well, he also directed Ring of the Nibelungs, which looks like Lord of the Rings, but German. If you look at the cover for it.
Oh, there was a TV version of Lord of the Rings done.
It just looks very like Aragorn on the cover.
Let's have a look. What is the movie Ring of the Nibelungs about?
Oh, he did four episodes of Homicide: Life on the Street.
Yeah, that makes sense.
That's cool.
No, it isn't actually anything to do with Lord of the Rings.
No, it just looks like it.
Yeah, yeah. TV movie from 2004 with...
Oh, he wrote it too.
Max von Sydow was in that. And Lilith Hewitt from Twin Peaks, weirdly enough. Starring Benno Furman. Benno.
Benno.
I didn't realise, you know, Ben Mendelsohn, the Australian actor.
Yeah.
All of his mates call him Mendo. So whenever I see him now, I'm like, oh, it's Mendo. The Mendolorian, he should be.
Oh, my God.
Well, he was in Rogue One, so it's not a huge leap, is it? You know,
That's bad.
Okay, so a couple of quick bits of housekeeping before we get talking about this episode that seems to be confusing Hannah.
Don't worry, I've just basically had a mini brain breakdown.
One thing that we should point out,
actually, I blame the perimenopause.
Well, what this is a little useful bit of context is that I think we mentioned before is that we record after we have put the kids to bed. And Hannah has the tough assignment because Hannah has to put our son to bed, who takes a lot more effort, which basically means Hannah needs to lie in essentially a dark room next to him until he falls asleep. So Hannah is usually in somewhat of a dazed state when we start recording. So I think that is fair. Whereas I usually get to put our daughter to bed, which takes about 5 minutes, and have usually watched an episode of television or played a video game by the time Hannah comes back in.
And our son is the cuddliest child around. Yeah. So it's pretty relaxing.
Yeah.
I invariably fall asleep.
Yes.
Also, I do want to call you out on something. I thought you were making me a cup of tea.
I have. It's in there.
Where is it?
Yeah.
I just went to have a drink and I don't have my cup.
Well, I'll...
See? I do remember things.
I'll consult IMD and see what's...
IMT.
IMT. Have we got any feedback, by the way?
No.
Okay, well, in that case...
Nobody loves us.
Feedback, guys, come on. I definitely want to make sure that we start getting feedback by the time we move into season 3 of Twin Peaks, because that's one that I haven't really ever had a chance to discuss with anyone. Mm, yeah. So...
Might have to see if Mark wants to come on from the good, the bad. The
oh,
God.
Yes.
And Becky, maybe. Yeah. Becca as well.
Yeah, Rebecca. Cool. Rebecca's are confusing, aren't they? Because
Because we know a Mark and a Becky.
No.
And who like Twin Peaks.
Every Rebecca I have ever known has one version of their name they hate.
Yeah.
Every Rebecca ever either hates Bex or Becky or Becca or what? There's one version of their name that every Rebecca since the dawn of time hates.
Yeah.
So anytime I'm around a Rebecca, I'm self-conscious and confused. And I'm like, which one is it with this one again? It's really hard to so don't, you know. Yeah. Speaking of which.
We should sort that out.
We appreciate feedback at rewatchprojectpodcast@gmail.com, or you can leave comments on the YouTube channel. We will read those out on the show. Also, please check out our friend shows, namely Chin Stroker vs. Punter, his film, Her Movie. The Entertainment Landlord's coming back. I know I was on I'm on their Discord, and Jason said that they have just recorded a new episode. I've never seen with Stephen. I'm not sure who's on it. But I know that Jason is podcasting again, and that should be out soon. So
that's great.
Check out the Nowhere in Mulberry Entertainment Landfill feed for that. Also, Film Bastards, The Good, the Bad, and the Odd, and Talk Without Rhythm podcast. Check those out as well. We are on Twitter, on Instagram, where in both cases we are at Rewatch Proj. That's Rewatch Proj. And also reviews on Apple Podcasts and on Spotify are very much appreciated. But I need to go and get Hannah's cup of tea, which will be cooling on her now. So I need to get that sorted out. And we will hit pause and we will watch the 14th episode of season 2 of Twin Peaks and then come back and tell you what we thought of it.
Good afternoon, good morning, good evening, and welcome to Film Bastards, a podcast where three friends, two of them married and two of them podcasting life partners, chat everything from new releases, trailers, news, and an eclectic mix of other film goodies, and many, many, many tangents. You can find them by searching your podcast provider or check them out on Twitter and Instagram by searching Film Bastards. You never know, you might like it. And if you don't, well, we don't really give a f***.
Here we go with some absolutely uncontrue. Oh, I'm on fire.
You're good to go.
Fucking hell.
Oh my God, it's the bag.
What has happened to my brain?
I am genuinely interested in what you were trying to say though.
I don't know what I was trying to say. I honestly feel like menopause might be hitting me and I've lost all brain cells.
Well, I mean...
I'm the right age for it.
Yeah.
Strap in, it's going to be a bumpy ride.
You know what, though? You know when you hear about, like, crazy people who get a knock on the head and it sends them right? Maybe it's going to be one of those. It'll weirdly level you out. Like, you... seriously, what were you going to say?
I don't know.
What, you just can't remember?
No.
No. Okay. And we're back. So, Hannah, we have just finished watching the 14th episode of season 2 of Marvel's Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. of Twin Peaks. What are your thoughts on this episode?
Well, who fucking knows what my thoughts are? Not me.
I feel like you need to give some context.
I just basically had a verbal breakdown before we started recording.
Okay.
Listeners.
Yeah, and that's what Hannah's in reference to.
Anyway. I really like the creepy Hansel and Gretel vibes to this episode. Mm-hmm. Not just in the very overt Leo finding the cottage in the woods,
yeah.
But that sort of sense of someone searching for the nice path in life. Like it's a very nursery rhyme-esque kind of thing.
Oh, I see what you mean, yeah.
Like James is trying to find his way back to the, quotes, good side.
That's a good point. There's a lot of kind of thematic cohesion in this episode, I think.
Shelley, obviously, dealing with her whole scenario.
Her excellent taste in men.
Yeah.
Her unblemished track record for great decisions.
Good. I thought this was the episode where they reenact... you know, the whole thing for Ben. So I was kind of expecting that, and obviously that didn't happen. But I like that we're sort of heading that way.
Yes.
Like, I remember that. I remember really enjoying that.
Yeah.
I thought it was a really good episode in covering a lot of ground, but it not being too bitsy. Like, it did feel quite cohesive.
Yes.
The whole way through. I love Lucy coming into her own sort of like, fuck this shit.
Yeah.
Get in here. I'm sorting this out right now.
Yeah,
I'm not going to let this fuck about for, you know.
She's got a lot more agency than she has previously.
Yeah, yeah. And I like that in her character. I also like the fact that she's still Lucy in that she's sort of horrified that she managed to kill a fly.
Yeah.
I really enjoyed it. What about you?
Yeah, I really like this episode as well. And again, I feel like it's a bit of a that's more like it kind of episode because although the show is still finding its way, a bit like Hansel and Gretel, finding its way back, it feels like this is where, and it's probably too little too late because I think commercially the writing was probably on the wall for the show at this point.
But well, there's eight episodes left?
I feel like this is the point where the show figures out what an ongoing 22 episodes a season Twin Peaks would look like.
Mm.
Because you had the 8-episode first season, then you had the first 8 episodes of season 2 up until when they sold Laura Palmer, and then they were kind of like trying to figure it out. And I think that by having Cooper being a deputy and this new threat coming in that tonally feels Twin Peaksy, feels dark and kind of mysterious and theatrical.
And slightly otherworldly.
Yeah, exactly. Kind of is it or isn't it?
Mm.
Makes sense and feels like that's what the show could be. If the show had just continued on like, you know, the X-Files
A different sort of main agenda in Twin Peaks every
season or half season.
Yeah.
And like they'd
focus on a different character being the central drama.
They'd figured out how to keep Cooper in the show and still have him involved in investigations.
Yep.
And they'd found another storyline that's, you know, not as compelling as Who Killed Laura Palmer, because there are a few things as compelling as a murder mystery. You know, it's the murder mystery is such a pure hook, you know, and that's why they chose it as the one. So I feel like this is the point where they figured it out.
Yeah.
And I think also by having the connection to Cooper and all the stuff with Major Briggs, they found a way of continuing the sort of the mythology of the town.
Yeah.
As well. So when you're seeing, and just other little things as well, like bringing Donna into the James and Evelyn storyline.
I thought that was a real metaphor for the, like you say, the show getting back on track. Like she rescues him from that.
Well, it's like storyline,
and like come away, we've got to get away from
this. And like having an interesting storyline for Pete and Catherine, and how much they use Doc Haywood. It's like it's as though and Jacoby being involved in several storylines. It's as though they suddenly figured out how to use the characters again, you know? And, you know, I mean, they were just typing pages, basically, for about a three-episode run where, and again, I recommend Reflections, the book, sort of the definitive oral history of Twin Peaks book, because they literally were, when they had to repurpose a storyline, were writing the script the night before they were filming it. Mm. They were literally just filming it as quickly as they could write it. And I think that by the time they got to this point, they'd kind of caught up.
Mm.
So I think that this is the first episode since the Laura Palmer storyline where they were actually had a creative environment.
Yeah.
Where they were able to actually breathe enough to think about what was best for the show, not just we've got to get 15 pages into the fax machine by 9 o'clock tomorrow morning.
Yeah.
You know, so I feel that if the show had been able to continue on, I feel like this is what the show would have been, because you couldn't maintain the level of surreality and intensity and filmmaking that you had in the first 16 episodes of the show, making 22 a year. That just doesn't happen. It's just not possible. But I think that this is what it would have leveled out as being. Mm. But I think also the episode's just better structured. Like, you know, it doesn't feel completely breakneck when you transition from murder victims, because that's the other thing as well, of course, is that we've got there's a serious crime element. There's death has returned to the show. I mean, there was crime before, but it was like, you know, Hank and Ernie and Jean Reno
kind of. You just sort of can't really take them seriously.
Yeah, exactly. But this is threat. A sense of threat has returned to the show. That needed to be there. But still, when they flip to the Dick and Andy show, it doesn't feel as jarring.
Well, it feels in context and...
Well, it feels like Twin Peaks.
Yeah. Because they still have moments of levity with, like, the whole widow... I was going to say Widow Twanky.
Widow Twanky, yeah.
you know, like, that whole, like, her bewitching all the men in the town and stuff. Like
Jazzling.
For Jazzling. Digmatized. it is a comedic break. But it makes sense.
But when the majority of the episode has this threatening element to it, that just feels like a moment of local colour.
Mm.
In the same way that in the original series, in season one, you'd be getting all this stuff and then they'd be like, who's the lady with the log? Oh, that's the log lady. Just those little moments. It feels more of a piece with that. But when you've got episodes where that's all it is, where you'll have the Dick and Andy show, but then you'll have Nadine at high school, and then you'll have Ben Horn doing his... You know, I just think
frickin' Evelyn, what's his face?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Whereas here, those elements feel judicious. And also, those storylines are moving along, because even the Evelyn and James storyline, that's coming to its climax at this point, which is more exciting. Mm. You know, you've got the police turning up and you've got a character in danger and you want to find out what's going to happen. That's more interesting than just him swanning about fixing her car and like making out with her, you know, all that. It's just intrinsically on a storytelling level, it's more interesting.
Yeah.
But also I just feel that the way that the show compromises, because it is now a longer form regular TV show works better. So, for example, I feel like Rustic Cooper, I like Rustic Cooper in this episode more than the going fishing gee whiz Rustic Cooper. This feels like a more of a compromise between the slightly mysterious, somewhat dark character that we've seen before and the gee whizziness. And you also see that, because this show, this episode, I noticed things that you normally see on TV shows, like they repurpose music that was used in other scenes, like the scene where with Norma and Ed, that kind of nice bit of doo-woppy music was the music from that scene when Ben and Jerry are remembering the girl dancing with the torch.
Yeah, yeah.
And when you do 22 episodes of a TV show, you can't be creating original score for every scene.
No.
So you'll pull Kirk Fights the Gorn music from this episode and put it in this other one.
It has that ability to evoke the emotion that they're looking for.
You know, exactly. So what they're doing is they've got to the point now in the show where they've accepted, they've figured it out. They've figured out how to make a TV show.
I think also the reason, like part of the reason, in my opinion, that the episodes kind of went quite wayward after you find out about
Leland
and his death and all of that kind of thing, is you're kind of left with these leftover characters from the mystery that's been solved.
Yeah.
So it's not as compelling. We know it's not as compelling, but it's...
Why are we watching?
We're not interested in tying those bits up. They don't matter.
Yeah.
So to just have that left, it's a bit like finishing the main bit of your meal and having a side salad left that you kind of like, well, I don't really want to eat that.
Yeah.
And now dessert arrives.
You know what?
Can you tell I'm still a bit hungry?
Well, what I'm surprised they didn't do, and I do wonder if, I'll probably need to reread Reflections actually, but I'm surprised that they didn't double down on the Bob stuff more.
Mm.
Because, you know, the episode where Cooper and characters...
Well, then that comes back in.
It does, but that could have bought them a bit of time because, you know, the episode where Cooper and the characters learn about Leland and Leland dies ends with them going, where's Bob now? And you see the owl fly over and he's like, ooh. That could have been the dramatic spine of the show to keep things moving. And I'm surprised they didn't go that way. So I do wonder whether maybe it was just...
Maybe there was some conversation around that.
Have we gone too far into this supernatural territory?
Maybe they didn't know where it was going.
Yeah.
You know, and couldn't...
Well, I think partly it was the fact that David Lynch wasn't around. And I think that the metaphysical element of the show, he drove that.
Yeah.
And I don't know how much... You do start to see Mark Frost really returns to the show in the next few episodes, and you start to see his interest. Like Mark Frost is really fascinated in things like secret societies, like the whole Bookhouse Boys thing came from him, and he's really interested in things like the Freemasons and all that kind of stuff. So you start to see a little bit of that creeping. But no, I really enjoyed this episode, and it's funny because people do throw all of these episodes kind of together, this sort of like mid-period of season two. But I disagree. I think some episodes are markedly better than others.
Mm.
And I think that this one, because the last episode I enjoyed,
but it wasn't as good as this one. I was kind of
willing it along. Yeah. I was kind of like, come on, Twin Peaks. Come on. You can do it.
Well, we both said that, you know, it was definitely not our favourite.
Yeah. And... Mm. But I think that this episode, we want more.
Mm.
And that's ultimately when you know it's working, is when you want to watch the next one. Not because, you know, they've dignitized you with like a cliffhanger or something, but because you just want to watch more of it because you're enjoying being in Twin Peaks.
One thing that did stick out like a sore thumb for me is the fact that you realise just how little joy Ed has in his life because you're really not used to seeing him smile.
Yeah, he looks weird, doesn't he?
Really weird. It's a bit like seeing James smile.
Yeah.
There's a lot of pain in that family.
Yeah, yeah, there really is, isn't there?
No one understands it.
Well, shall we? They don't. Apart from when they listen to his music, of course.
Of course.
All right, well, shall we do the breakdown?
One other thing I was thinking is I kind of like that, you know, the scene with Donna and Evelyn. Evelyn, to me, is like the adult manifestation of what Donna was trying to be earlier on.
She's the depressing reality of that.
Yeah, and I think it's almost like good for Donna to have been confronted by that.
The cautionary tale.
Fucking hell. Yeah, I don't want to be doing that. And you can see her kind of, like, obviously she tells Donna that James is off and whatever, but she obviously doesn't trust her or believe her. But you can see why. She's looking at this persona that she was inhabiting herself.
Well, it's interesting as well because although the characters are very different and they've got different agendas, in some ways Evelyn represents the same thing to James that Harold Smith represented to Donna, which was the adult world.
Yeah.
You know, the idea that, like, Donna goes there and orders a coffee and Evelyn's drinking, like, a cocktail in the same way that Harold was, like, a man of books. He looked at orchids through his eyepiece. And, whereas Donna and James recorded music in their living room.
Yeah.
You know, I think that it's this idea of the adult world. But it's the sort of dichotomous thing of teenagers in Twin Peaks not really being teenagers because they're played by older actors, but also they're kind of representations of movie teenagers and specifically 1950s movie teenagers.
Teenagers who, you know, do what all teenagers do in that they want to be more grown up than they are. They think that they can handle adult life and be, you know, independent and cope with anything.
But also they live in a world of fantasy as well.
And the reality of what the world is actually like is scary.
And that's why I kind of, you know, even without irony, like characters like Donna and James, because it speaks to the kind of self-indulgent kind of my life is an opera. A little bit like, I mean, you mentioned, I think, the John Waters movie, Crybaby, you know. It's like, I'm amazed that Johnny Depp, young Johnny Depp, was never in a David Lynch film. Because he's perfect. If you look at those kind of rock and roll characters that Johnny Depp played very early on in his career in films like Crybaby and Gilbert Grape and Nightmare on Elm Street, you know, that's definitely the wind blowing something. That's such a quintessentially kind of Lynchian thing.
Mm.
I kind of give those characters a pass because I remember when I was a teenager as well and my life was a montage sequence. You know, that's how you think.
But
that's why you're so into music and movies and stuff when you're young, because that's how you experience the world.
Well, and also, like, having kids ourselves now, it's sort of knowing more about the development of the brain and, like, kids' development and teenage development.
And you see yourself in your kids as well, don't you?
Absolutely.
And it reminds you of, like, I remember being like that.
Yeah, but there's, like, physical things like the frontal lobe of your brain is not fully developed until you're 25. And
I'm still holding that for mine.
Yeah, well, I think you're missing yours. But the frontal lobe,
as a lober, I am offended by the comments.
The frontal lobe deals with reason, logic, basically that dramatic impulse, the
ability to remember the names of internet movie databases, stuff like that.
Yeah. But also to, like, to not be so self-centered in the world.
Well, it's pure ego, you know.
Yeah, yeah. So, you know, to see that sort of manifested in the characters, you can see why they're like that.
Yeah, you know,
and it is that very immature experience. And but, I mean immature in that, like, they're not adults. They're not adult characters.
Yeah, exactly. And although I think Twin Peaks does sometimes speak real truth about the human condition, it does so through the prism of characters who kind of know they're in a movie, you know, and are representations of things. And again, that's why I think whenever anybody tries to apply any kind of moralistic social justice agenda or prism or critique to Twin Peaks, I think ultimately they're being foolish because it doesn't exist in the real world at all.
Yeah.
You know, and it's not even tokenistically, it's not even like a representative of the real world. It's meant to be a tapestry of genre and avatarial kind of tropes. And the characters are, James isn't a person. He's a, he's a combination of genre tropes. But exactly, but other characters are, and that's the complexity of Twin Peaks that I think first-time viewers, particularly modern first-time viewers, wouldn't understand, because as an audience, we expect everything to be one thing. You know, we've got a very kind of, not even binary, a sort of monistic view of the world, where it's like, well, this is dumb. It was serious one minute, and now it's being silly. I don't get it. You know, there's, it's funny, Hannah and I are on the 10th season of The X-Files, and there's an episode coming up that I love, but that is really divisive, because loads of the audience were like, tonally, this thing's a mess. It's funny one minute and really harsh the next. And I don't, I've never struggled with that. I've never struggled with being able to reconcile those things. But it, a TV show or a movie or a work of art can be several things at once. And I think that one of the things that's great about Twin Peaks is not that it does all these weird things, but the way in which those things interact. And the example I always use of that is that scene in the first season when you've got Nadine and Norma having an awkward conversation in the convenience store. Like, Nadine's there to buy cotton balls for her, and she's just being nuts. And Nadine, and one of those characters, because she's one of those characters like Dr. Jacoby, or one of these characters who could only exist.
Sometimes they're super perceptive, and most of the time they're off with
They're just nuts. They're Lynchian characters.
Yeah.
And then you've got Norma, who is just, you know, normal Norma. You know, I mean, it's there in her name. And the energy of that scene is these two.
I bet she's on the IMD. Norma.
Is these two genres coming up against each other? You know, like, it'd be like having people breaking into song in the middle of a Mike Lee movie or something like that. And that's something.
See that.
And that's something that the show does really well. But I think that to when people look at the show and say that, I don't know, whatever modern thing you could apply to it, like, oh, it's misogynistic or it's transphobic or this character said this and it's not, it's like, you can't do that to this show.
No.
Because these aren't meant to be people. Some of them are.
Yeah.
And, like, I mean, for example, Sarah Palmer's pain when she finds out about Laura is one of the most realistic depictions of pure grief you will ever see.
Yeah.
But at the same time, you got Dick Tremaine, you know, so I mean.
Yeah, it was a caricature if ever you see one.
Well, he's like, he's out of a Carry On movie. Yeah. You know, it's that. But anyway. Yes.
What was that? You know,
Oh, yeah, Kenneth Williams.
Yeah.
But, that's one. So we see.
I love that you got that from that.
When I watched a documentary about the Carry On films yesterday, which is why they're so fresh in my mind. So it's just a coincidence that Kenneth Williams' noise is exactly the same as your mating call.
Yeah, well, how do you think I grabbed you?
Yeah, that's it. If ever I lose you in the woods, I'll... There she is.
Hark, I hear my lover's noise.
I do. I hear her clarion call. So we see Carl McLachlan's twin brother with the chess piece in his mouth, with a stabbed aorta. We learn more about that a little bit later.
I keep thinking, I wonder how difficult it was to just be dead on screen.
Let's find out, shall we? And it was funny, I've got a note here.
Well, because he's a person, like, you know, initially you think it's...
You're a person too, Hannah, don't be mean to yourself.
But, like, you think, like, if you don't know that Kyle McLachlan has a twin, you think it's, like, they've made a dummy or something of him because it looks so much like him.
See, I never made that connection the first time I watched. It was on a rewatch when I saw the name and then... And it was so funny as well because this is before the internet, and I often think, how did we know stuff before the internet? I mean, how did we... Because I knew that at some point and learned all of this, and I remember telling people, and it's like, I suppose fanzines, I guess, or magazines or whatever, but it just seems...
The printed word.
The acquisition of knowledge in the pre-internet age is just... we figured it out somehow.
You had to work for it.
But I always knew that. Like, when I was at school, I remember when the original Star Wars films came out, and I heard somebody talking about this in a podcast recently. Like, I knew that Darth Vader became Darth Vader because he had a fight with Obi-Wan Kenobi and got destroyed by lava.
Yeah.
And that was just something that we just knew. And it was like, where the hell did that information come from?
Because school used to be like the internet.
Yeah.
Now it's just a place to get beaten up. But, like...
Oh, plenty of that happened back in my day as well.
But, like, if you wanted the gossip, you went to school.
Yeah.
Didn't you?
Yeah.
I mean...
That's where I go for my gossip now.
But it's a bit like, you know, back in the day you'd find your porn in the hedge.
Yeah.
You know, school was the place that if there was any news to be heard...
We didn't have the internet. We had playgrounds and hedges.
Yeah.
For all of our needs.
Basically.
Although
the porn in the hedge thing, I think that's quite British. I've never found a porn magazine. Well, I mean, the hedges in New Zealand are usually attached to somebody's front lawn.
Yeah, exactly.
Unless they're just like got an absurd amount of porn.
Yeah, I mean, that's a very British sort of topographically specific way
like
of
railway sidings and things like that, wasn't it?
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Mm. We got a railway just down there. We could get the torches out.
Go
down and
look for some porn.
Go on a sociological expedition. But I've got a note here about how, and this proved to be wrong actually, which is a good thing, I guess. But you've got all the stuff at the beginning with them finding the body and Cooper doing a bit of exposition about Windermere. And I was thinking, gosh, a lot of these episodes recently have got like loads of stuff at the beginning and loads of stuff at the end. And then you'll have all the kind of silly town stuff. So I thought, that's happening again here. But it's actually. And I think this is when it became apparent that the show had kind of found its way back a little bit, is it's actually peppered throughout the whole episode.
Yeah, it is.
Where it's as though for the last few episodes, they were like, right, okay, this is the main bit of business that we've got. We've got all these other mad storylines that we've got to continue as well. So let's just have a bit of the good stuff at the beginning and the end. So it'll bring people into the episode and get them to watch the next one. And then we'll just wade through the Evelyn and the Nadine and Mike and all that kind of stuff and make it as good as we can.
I mean, you know? I never watched it, but I'm picking that was sort of the Walking Dead approach to TV.
Yeah, yeah. Well, the main thing with Walking Dead was he changed showrunners every 10 episodes. So it was just, okay, what's the show now?
Oh, God.
You know, it's one of those kind of things. Yeah. It all gets a bit Star Wars-y. As well, when Cooper's like, he's been here, I can feel his presence.
Yeah.
You know?
The force is strong.
It is. And so we see Audrey and Bobby having a conversation about how they need to get Ben back to reality. And Audrey's trying to motivate Bobby by his sort of greed and his sense that maybe he can exploit Ben.
I love how she's quite metaphorical and then realizes that
it's going over
too thick.
Yeah, he doesn't have those levels.
You know, do you want to get rich?
Yeah.
Right.
And it's all, so then we move over to Shelley and it's all very sort of Friday the 13th kind of slasher movie. Yeah, we're seeing the owl.
I didn't like that, but...
Yeah, I could see you sort of disappearing there. A bit like Leo, Into the Woods, at the end of this sequence as well. And it's quite nice as well. You get the sense that maybe Shelley and Bobby have kind of rebonded a little bit through their sort of the trauma of their experience with Leo. And also...
Trauma that Bobby basically manipulated into happening.
Yeah, yeah. And it occurs to me watching this as well, because obviously one of the things about Twin Peaks is, you know, the whole, apart from that one, I think, three-day time jump at the end of the Laura Palmer storyline, you know, each episode's a day, is that you see Cooper and Truman in the sheriff's station in the morning. And I've forgotten that Cooper's still awake from all of the stuff at Dead Dog Farm.
Yeah.
You know, so he's had a shit long night.
Yeah, he really is.
And also, I noticed as well, they're restyling Cooper a little bit as well. Like, if you notice, he's not all of his hair's back now. He's got a little bit that sort of hangs down.
Yeah, the last couple of episodes. Crybaby curl.
Yeah. So it's almost as though I think that they're trying to slightly redesign the iconic version of Cooper. Because before, he was all, his hair was always immaculately kind of
gelled back. But I think it will probably go back like that when he's back in a suit.
Oh, no, absolutely. But this is the sort of the, you know, this is the... Rural Cooper, the rural drawer.
Rural drawer, yeah.
So we learn that Cooper's been cleared, but he still can't return to service. So that's an excuse kind of for the show to keep him deputized.
Mm-hmm.
We see that Hank didn't make the buy. Now, they completely screwed the chronology of the storytelling. I only caught this about the third or fourth time. And I think they realized it in editing, but didn't completely fix it. Because you've got... Norma goes over to Ed's and they do lots of that kissing that makes you uncomfortable.
Yeah.
And then...
They'd hide the salami.
And then Hank appears in the living room.
Yeah.
And Nadine beats the shit out of him.
Yeah.
The next scene, you're at Dead Dog Farm and you've got the Mountie and you've got Jean Reno and all of that. But and you know how he's got the wire on him? In that conversation, Hank... is in the room. You hear Hank talking with them all in Dead Dog Farm. But when they break in, Hank's not there. And then Truman in this episode says, oh, Hank never made it to the buy at Dead Dog Farm because he was in hospital. And what I think happened was they had him in that scene. And then at some point they decided, oh, let's re-edit the episode and make the scene with Nadine earlier. But by having that happen, he couldn't be in that scene. So they obviously edited him out, but forgot or missed editing him out the audio of the bit when they're listening in. So when I was, I think I'd heard this a while ago and it just sort of stuck in my mind, in my subconscious. And during that scene, I was like, how can Hank be there? Because I could hear his voice. But when they break in, he's not. And it's one of, I mean, that's like a 10th watch kind of thing, but...
I don't even remember hearing Hank's voice.
It's like it's one line of dialogue. He's just like, hey, calm down, Ernie. You're being, you know. And I mean, you could even argue that it's not him, meant to be him in the scene, but he clearly is. He clearly is the actor. Andy tells Lucy about Nikki. We see Mr. Marsh in his wonderful 1990 shell suit as well. Do you remember that fashion trend of the early 90s? And I love how many, whenever you get scenes when people are implying things in a TV way, like there's a bit where...
I believe we have a shared interest.
Yeah. Cars.
Yeah.
And then Evelyn gets in on it and she's like, oh, there's plenty of things for him to do.
Yeah.
Like me, on the car. And she's like, you know...
On the mud guard, the wheel guard, or whatever it is.
So we see Ed talks to Dr. Hayward about Nadine. They talk about how she's got extra adrenaline and how that's manifesting itself. We see...
Ed really, like, kind of implies that they're fucking day and night.
Yeah.
Like, the way he's going on.
Yeah. And he mentions that... Doc Hayward mentions that Donna took the van to go and see James. And Norma says that Hank is going to prison. And they talk about the future whilst, that, I say, that nice kind of doo-wop music from the earlier episode plays.
They're sort of seeing that light at the end of the tunnel.
Yes, they are. We see James talking about how it's wrong that what they're doing, and he looks out the window in pain, obviously. In pain,
yeah.
I've got my notes about Cooper's hair here. Mm-hmm. Cooper tells Truman about Windermere and their history and about how Caroline was
Caroline
was his wife, was Windermere's wife.
Sweet Caroline.
He also thinks that Wyndham, or what was it you called him?
Winsome.
maybe killed her. And he talks about how he's got a mind like a diamond. And one of the moments in this episode where I thought, yeah, we're getting back to Twin Peaks now, is when Cooper's like, and Carl McLaughlin's really good in this scene. The camera's quite close on his face, and he's like, you don't know what he's capable of. You just don't know. And it fades to shots of the woods at night. Does it a couple of times.
Does it with Eckhart as well.
Yeah. Yeah, and it's just like, oh, yeah, this feels like Twin Peaks again. Yeah. And we see Donna at Wally's hideout, and Evelyn. I love the way that Evelyn just kind of hangs there, almost like a Venus flytrap, waiting just to ensnare people.
Yeah.
Like, she's just there drinking cocktails with, like, this one bartender.
She absolutely should have stumbled off that bar stool, though, if she's drinking martinis at time it was.
This is what I mean, though, about these characters from different genres brushing up against each other, because clearly she's meant to be the classic femme fatale from film noir. But normally they would be sat drinking a cocktail out of one of those weird cocktail glasses, but in like a hotel in Casablanca or something, you know. But because she's in Twin Peaks, she's in some shitty hick bar where it makes no sense for her to be. But because that's her character, she's there. So you've got this, it's like seeing James Dean in a science fiction movie.
I thought it was kind of amazing that a bar sold both martinis and coffee.
Mm. Although it was that old school coffee in the big glass, the fact, you know,
big, tastes like petrol. But, you know, the fact they had any hot drinks.
I mean, I remember the cinema I worked at, we sold coffee, but this was pre, because in the UK, coffee was like 50p or a quid. And it was that shit coffee that you'd
really
cook with,
coffee.
That you know, with the paper things that you'd, and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
And then Starbucks
filter coffee
appeared. Yeah, filter coffee. And then immediately, coffee was £5.
Mm.
It was like from 50p to £5. I mean, I know it's nicer, but is it 10 times nicer? Actually, it probably is 10 times nicer in fairness. So we see. We hear Just You and I, James's Song of Pain. And I like the way that Ben's Civil War madness kind of upscales slightly every episode. Like, the scale of it goes up just one notch every
episode. I love
episode.
That Jacoby is totally invested.
He's not helping the situation.
No, it's really not.
He just seems to be encouraging it to see what's going to happen.
Yeah. It's, he is just loving it.
It's like, you know, on Seinfeld when, like, George has a really dumb idea and Seinfeld's like, yeah, why don't you do that? Like, because he just wants to be like, he just wants to
just
see.
Just wants to see what the outcome will be. Yeah.
But what we learn basically is that Jacoby's logic is that by reversing the Southern defeat in the Civil War.
He's going to reverse his own fortunes.
Yeah, so he needs, like, the Confederacy to win. In order to regain his sanity. Mm. I love the way that Ben, being Ben, he's nuts, but he's still cognitive enough to turn the fan on to make the flag.
I can imagine our son being like that if he goes mad in his later years, find a flag, put the fan on.
Well, also, I mean, what we're seeing with Ben is it's clearly some kind of regressive behaviour, like, the implication is that he was probably fascinated with the Civil War when he was a kid.
We've
seen this with Ben a few times, you know, this kind of connection to this craving for the simplicity.
Mm.
You know, he loves all of the Machiavellian, fighting and battling that he does. But I think deep down, he's just tired of it.
Yeah.
You know. I love the way that when we see Major Briggs wander in and collapse, Lucy's like, oh my God, are you okay? But then finishes doing her lipstick before calling anyone else.
And I find it quite unsatisfying, the conversation he has with Cooper and thingy.
Truman.
Harry. Because he kind of, like, I thought he'd be saying a lot more than he does. It goes against type, I know.
Basically, he's there to remind the audience about the White Lodge.
Yeah.
And also that he's starting to suspect that maybe it's not completely altruistic, the reasons that's been... that's been investigated.
I love the way he talks. It's like listening to a deep tone.
He's like the white Morgan Freeman, isn't he?
But like he's very, the words that they choose for him are so, he's verbose.
Mm. Yeah, he is. And like, I love the way that the scene starts with all the... I like the way that the scene starts with all of them drinking water.
Yeah.
And they're loving it. They're like, oh, yeah. And she's like, more water. And they're like, oh, this is great. It's like they've never had water. It's just this weird moment.
Yeah.
But he says he was taken to the White Lodge and that there's much trouble ahead. And he says, I will be in the shadows if you need me. And I love the way that Truman's like, I'll be in the shadows. Can you beat that? And Cooper's like, no. Like, really sincerely, kind of like, I can't. And
I love that they both time putting their glasses down together when Andy says to can he show them something?
But with hindsight, the thing that's clever about this scene is, and it's only just occurred to me, but I think this is what they were trying to achieve, and I think they do, I just think it's subconscious, is they're trying to connect in your mind the White Lodge and this mystery, which we know is connected to Bob and this all the woods and all of this other stuff.
Mm.
He connects it with Windham Earl.
Yeah.
Because he's like, you know, there's trouble ahead, and we know that Cooper and the show is the main predilection is that troubles come to town. Mm. So I think what it does really well is it makes you feel that all of this is part of one larger whole. You know, it's not, these aren't disparate things.
No.
But there's, and it might be a subconscious just darkness thing, or it could be that they are, and we will learn that they are actually very specifically connected. But I think that's a good move.
Yeah.
We see Jacoby and the Milford widow, the widow Twanky. I love the way that when the mayor pulls the gun, he's like, don't move. And you too, hippie, to Jacoby as well. Because to him, Jacoby would be a hippie, wouldn't he? And,
well, he looks like an extra off Sergeant Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band.
And I love the way that when they're waiting, Jacoby just gets the giggles.
Yeah, yeah.
It's almost like he can't deal with the awkwardness of the silence. Yeah. And he just finds it amusing. And then they go in and he says, we decided to adopt. And we see that she has, you know, bejazzled him as well.
Yeah.
We see Pete and Catherine. And she explains about how she survived
the
fire.
She looked like she was going to, like, snog the face off her brother at one point.
Oh, no, I think it's just, she's just being evil. It's a soap opera kind of thing,
please,
isn't it?
Please don't kiss him. That's
weird. And so we see that Andrew Packard is still alive, and they talk about how Thomas Eckhart was his business partner, and you know, the relationship went sour, and that he kind of deployed Josie to kill him.
Mm.
But they got wind of this and faked the death. The great David Warner playing Thomas Eckhart as well, a great stage and film actor.
Fabulous in Star Trek.
Yes, yes, yes. He played a few roles in Star Trek.
There's four lights.
There are four lights. We see Lucy confront Dick and Andy with Doc Hayward. Hayward gets a lot to do in this episode. He's involved in nearly every storyline.
I think he's brilliant in this episode. And it's lovely to see a bit more of him.
Yeah.
You know, he's a great character.
He mentions that he delivered Dick.
Yeah.
You know, he's like, I didn't drop you on your head then. Don't make me... regret that. And, you know, there's that weird moment when at the end of the scene where Lucy kills the bug. That feels very, very Lynchian.
I just love how shocked she looks that she's done it.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. We see James packing and Evelyn says, I love you, James. And obviously what she's doing is she's stalling to try and keep him there until the police get there. And he realises that she set him up. And she kind of turns a little bit and she's just like, look, find that girl who loves you. Go, go, go. And it is Donna.
I love that the other guy is nowhere to be found.
Yeah, the brother.
Quote Mark's yeah. brother.
So we see Donna finds him, and then we see Leo in the woods and Windermere. And I love the staging in the scene with Windermere, the way, you know, you see the chessboard, and it's kind of like a great character reveal where you get all of the kind of the iconography of the character. You see his gun, you see he's wearing a suit, you see the chessboard. You
know, I love that he is wearing the FBI suit.
Yeah, yeah, like, exactly. Yeah. So he connects him to Cooper in your mind as well.
Mm.
So it's kind
what
of like
all the stuff that's hanging down in that.
I'm not sure. I mean, we spend a bit of time there in the next episode, so I guess we'll get to see. But, you know, there's always been this implication that Cooper's brought something with him. Like the scene when they're interrogating Leland, when Bob's out and he's just like, I've got a thing for knives. Like that time with you in Pittsburgh, Cooper.
Yeah.
You see Cooper stand back like, fuck, you know. And when Audrey's like, oh, you know, you're perfect. And he's like, no, I'm not. Mm. You know, it's like that's all kind of coming home to roost. But I like the fact that just by revealing the character and showing you know who it is before you see his face, it just creates this sense of kind of importance and value, you know, to it, which is just good filmmaking.
Mm.
And the fact that, you know, Uli Edel, you know, who directed this episode, was a film director. He would go on to be a TV director, like most film directors do eventually. But he was a guy who made films that were released at the cinema. And, you know, I think you can see that. You can see that there's a cinematic eye on this episode.
Mm.
And we see that it's Windermere. But any final thoughts, Hannah, before we wrap up?
Bring on the next one. I think we're into a very, very excellent run of viewing.
Yeah, it's all killer from here on out. Cool. Okay. Well, quick reminder that we...
what the next one is.
Yeah. Quick reminder that we appreciate feedback at rewatchprojectpodcast@gmail.com, at rewatchproj on Twitter and on Instagram. Check out our friend shows. Leave comments on YouTube and also reviews on Apple Podcasts and Spotify are very much appreciated. What are we talking about next time, Anna?
The next episode is called Slaves and Masters. Synopsis says, the police look for James in the Marsh murder. Bobby and Shelley tell Truman that Leo escaped, and Bobby reveals that he saw Hank shoot Leo the night the mill burned. Albert returns to Twin Peaks with information on Wyndham Earl.
Yay, Albert's coming back.
Yay. It's directed by Diane Keaton.
Crazy.
And written by Harley Payton and Robert Engels.
Nice. Solid people behind that one.
Yeah.
I'll look forward to that. Okay, so that's us for now, and we will see you soon. Goodbye.
Bye.